Welcome back. We are going to continue now. Just a word about the next two speakers. We're not going to have a discussion after Dr. Walden's paper. We're going to try and combine discussions and confine them to the period after Stephen Cross and Stella Walden have both spoken. Our next speaker, Dr. Stella Walden, is a psychotherapist who worked for many years at the Portman Clinic, which is just next door here, and in private practice. She is the founder of the International Association for Forensic Psychotherapy and a fellow of the Royal College of Psychiatrists. She's most famous for her book, Mother, Madonna, Whore, The Idealization and Denigration of Motherhood, which importantly quashed the myth that perversion was largely a male preserve and opened up a whole new field of therapeutic inquiry. In 1997, Oxford Brookes University awarded her an honorary doctorate of science degree for her contributions in the field of forensic psychotherapy. And this year, she was invited to become an honorary member of the American Psychoanalytic Association. She is, as you will have seen from your notes, principal editor of A Practical Guide to Forensic Psychotherapy and the author of Sadomasochism. Her latest publication is Playing with Dynamite, A Personal Approach to Understanding of Perversions, Violence and Criminality. And as it says, her interest in Wagner is long-standing, as is our interest in hearing what she has to say. Please join me in welcoming Dr. Walden.
Well, thank you very much for inviting me. As a matter of fact, I think we have to give a big ovation to Ivan Gord, who is the creator of today, and who has been in his mind this day for decades. So finally, he's got it. So, congratulations, Ivan. Wagner and Freud, what do they have in common? Regardless of the 43 years gap and their different fields of creative work, what about their discoveries regarding mythical creations? In my talk, I shall concentrate on the subject of gender, woman sexuality, and power. So I will try to address some of the psychoanalytical theories regarding female sexuality and will center on Brunhilde and her psychosexual development from being a chaste virgin young woman to a mature woman in love, and later, a leader of a new world. I had taken for granted the usual comments about Wagner being an anti-feminist and about Freud being sympathetic to women and aware of their unconscious sexual desires. However, I must admit, I have been challenged on both assumptions. I shall try to explain myself. The first time I saw Valkyrie, I was impressed by the very dramatic scene when Wotan dispossesses his daughter Brunhilde of her goddess state because of her disobedience. And in a rage, he says something like, "You admire those humans so much, you can become one, endure their lives, and be a human woman, and then you will have to marry the first man who claims you." We shall see how do you like that. Well, I was amazed. I thought, this is not a statement of an ordinary father, since most of them, they want their young daughters to be married. Perhaps, after all, Wagner is a feminist, since he seems so aware of how women are socially oppressed. And this took me back to my own father. My father, although born towards the end of the 19th century, was a freethinker, a radical publisher in Argentina. He was highly political, anarchic, a firm believer in women's liberation long before it took root. When away from home, already living in the UK and confiding in him my big excitement at the discovery of being pregnant, his response was not only most unusual, but also unexpected, telling me, "I am not at all impressed about this. Any woman can be pregnant, but much more is expected from you." In other words, his expectations about myself as a person were of a different dimension. Freud, Though a genius was as a man unable to convey a full understanding of the complexities of the libidinal developments of the two genders, he made the Oedipus complex exclusively based on the male model. In my book, Mother Madonna Ho, I tried to challenge his views about women's sexuality, especially regarding perversions, when he assumed that women were unable to perform perversions since they do not have penises. So my argument went, well, women do not have penises, but they have babies. So, as opposed to men who act their perversion against others outside, in women, their object of perversion, harm, is against themselves, or against objects of their own creation, babies. And the fact that they can harm babies has been widely and sadly demonstrated in the last few years. Freud's famous aphorism, "What does a woman want?" is a kind of admission. Was he saying that men were unable to understand women's desires, sensuality, and sexuality, and their own access to power? Now we're faced with Wagner as a psychologist of women, since he has produced a real challenge of womanliness in the depiction of Brunhilde as both a woman in power and a woman in love. This came to me as a surprise, having always read of Wagner being a misogynist and described as anti-feminist and highly narcissistic. I was again surprised that the world portrayed by him, especially in The Ring, shows that women are in command, since they are far more reliable and trustworthy. In Rainbow, we see different psychological characteristics that could be translated to different kinds of female power. Here it is clearly demonstrated that the real power belongs to the women. Fricka appeals to the moral rules of the bourgeoisie's commands by representing the law of marriage. Freya, by her apparent vulnerability, by her tacit power of being the goddess of youth, whereby her absence means the loss of immortality of all gods. And lastly, Erda, the goddess of wisdom, ruling by her total knowledge. If we agree with Brian McGee that it is, quote, it is possible to see the various characters of the ring as multifarious aspects of a single personality, then all these figures, what psychoanalysts call internal objects, may also be aspects of Wagner as well, and perhaps all of us. So, what is Wagner saying by giving all power to women and making men appear so greedy, so cruel, so treacherous, and never satisfied with their own quests? In Rheingold, this is a world apparently dominated by men who are involved in power and gold to such an extent that they are ready to renounce love, undermining its power. Instead, women's clear and consistent priority is love. With the psychoanalytical theories, the origin of love starts as a mother-baby unit, and it is biological, psychological peak is when the mother is ready, with her breasts full, filled up with milk, just as her baby is being awakened by hunger. It's a fantastic combination that is unique. Both parties get together, and a world of bliss is open to them. Of course, having accepted the reality principle, we know that the two individuals will never be able to relive these moments in quite the same way. We may try to reproduce the utopian situation, but the older we become, the more we grow to appreciate that our expectations are necessarily limited. However, some individuals go on forever looking at the exact reproduction of this first and unique relationship. And of course, their longing for that first love can go on forever, bringing nothing but frustration. At times I wonder if Wagner's music is recognizable by a contradiction to go forward for a new, more realistic loving, or to regress to this ideal baby-mother unit, which is always doomed to any failure and to produce deep frustration, since the unconscious desired goal is never realized. Alex Ross describes this process in a more eloquent manner, saying, quote, marked by Wagner's music, marked by a constant tension between a will to power and a willingness to surrender. The contradiction is not one that we should seek to resolve. Rather, it is integral to the survival of the composer's work. End of quote. For women, the act of making love takes on a different dimension than for men, since the women are far more aware of using the same organ for sexual pleasure as for procreation. The indescribable richness which is created when a man and a woman make love beautifully may come home in a particularly poignant way to women. Female patients have told me of how they experience orgasm and even conception as a symbolic invasion of their vagina by a baby during sexual intercourse with their partner. Many women have talked of having fantasies that during sexual intercourse they have felt protective and caring towards the partner because he was experienced as a baby returning to the womb. This appears to be reciprocated by men's fantasies during intercourse. I remember a woman patient who told me about her latest lover request while in the act of making love. Quote, I want to get all my body inside your cunt. End of quote. My patient continued, quote, I felt terrified. It was as if this man's body would have become like a baby's, and he wanted to get back into mother's body, but it is my body. Men may easily appear to be the powerful ones, but let's think carefully about this easy and intellectually lazy assumption. The power of the womb distinguishes women from men and leads to the power of motherhood, truly as potent and as usually more far-reaching and more pervasive than the power of money, or law, or social position. It is a form of power which may take years or even generations to become fully manifest, and it is rarely reversible. This may appear to be gratuitously provocative in view of women's social position, the amount of domestic abuse and incidents of rape that they are subjected to. But some of the violence against women as individuals may be seen not as an evidence of powerlessness, but precisely the opposite, as a reaction against the power of motherhood and the fear it engenders. What is unusual about Brunhilde among Wagner's heroines and among all operatic heroines is that she is not just defined by a man's love, but also by her moral bravery and intellectual understanding, as many other authors have recognized. So it will be no surprise that I decided to center on Brunhilde. For me, she's the epitome of femininity. I cannot deny a slight identification with her as a female figure. She goes through an epic transformation in that she becomes more and more aware of her own female power, which she does use in the most sensible and mature way. During this process, she goes from being the chaste to being the driven. I believe this is the main reason for directors to make her play in different and sometimes what appears to be in opposite guises. I shall keep in mind two different productions from the same year, 2005, so-called feminist productions. These are director Phyllida Lloyd's production of the ENO and Casper Holten's at the Royal Danish Opera House, now famously known as the Copenhagen Ring. We will not be surprised that in each director's view, her end is depicted in different and almost opposite ways, but actually both endings very much represent unconscious aims. Of course, Sublime works of art are always open to many interpretations according to different contemporary political, cultural, and social circumstances. It is highly important to note that these two different productions are the products of creativity of a woman and a man, both take into account the important role of a changing society, in which the traditional patriarchal system is challenged and contested, as it is in present times. In the Valkyrie, there's no doubt that the main hero is a woman. When we see first, from Hilda appearing on the stage, she's without doubt Wotan's favorite daughter. There she is, galloping away, accompanied by well-known musical theme of the Rite of the Valkyries. She has, like the other Valkyries, the maternal responsibility for carrying dead heroes into immortality in Valhalla for Wotan. In the Copenhagen production, in her first encounter with Wotan, she looks adoringly at him and tells him, "Who am I, if not your will?" She's locked in a strong Oedipal situation. Brunhilda is in an amorous interaction with Wotan. They are both aware that Fricka is approaching, but they don't seem to mind this at all. Actually, they continue to have a casual dialogue full of complicity in that both of them appear as a couple, with mutual and reciprocal agreements. They even appear to be rather flippant and dismissive about Fricka, although she has other plans in mind. First, she approaches Wotan very seductively, but when he openly rejects her, when he openly rejects her approaches, she turns to be stern and strict. And in a very determined and exacting way, she makes it clear that he ought to obey her command. Reluctantly, but resigned, Wotan accepts. Incidentally, this is the start of his tragedy. Brunhilda is closely observing this scene between Wotan and Fricka. And from incredulity, she turns to be in open dismay at Wotan's eventual giving up to Fricka's demand. She feels rejected in this unconscious incest situation with her father. She cannot believe that her father, the god of gods, is now under his wife's moral demands, and as such, not worthy of her submission to his desires, since this would also imply her obedience to Fricka, whom she does not respect. This allows her to disengage from the strong Oedipal attachment to interject a different set of values which are mobilized into sublimation. From a long-lived latency period, she starts directing her libido to more suitable projects, such as sexual love and fecundity. She also becomes more aware of the reality principle in that she starts a process of thinking, which enables her to make her own decisions. The obedient, daughterly attitude changes when confronted by his command that she is now responsible for killing their favorite hero, Sigmund. Under the pressure from his wife, Fricka, who is indignant at Wotan's wish to protect Sigmund and Sigling, in her view, is condoning not only adultery but also incest. She tries to carry out this command, but to no avail, since the evidence of a true sensual love between Sigmund and Sigling will drive her to rebel against her father. She has now discovered the power of love, having previously been witness of the primal sin. The primal sin is the first time you discovered your parents having sex. In other words, you are the third person, the witness. It's a bit like also with Tristan and Isolde and King Mark coming to them as the third person. Although not all children witness their parents having sex, every child develops fantasies about what parents do behind closed doors. These fantasies depict altering identifications with each parent as well as the parental pair. Freud considered the primal sin to be traumatic because he believed the child could be overstimulated and be able to create anxiety that could result in symptom formation. Another reason for the traumatic nature of the primal sin is explained by the child's narcissistic injury of being rejected, excluded, or treated like an unwelcome intruder. Often, the child interprets the sexual act as a sadistic one, adding to his or to her own feelings of unease. In Brunhilda's case, the primal sin triggers her sexual awakening and awareness of the power of love. This is the blueprint she now wants for her own life. She now wants to have a baby, product of consensual union made of love, and not out of force like herself. She defends love above everything else because she feels herself to be a product of power and force. That is when we see her full of strength. But her vulnerability and frailty show when it becomes about consummation and of love and the possibility for her to fall in love. Siglind has now become a role model for Brunhilda. She and Sigmund are the perfect pair to be emulated. Brunhilda is a determined and courageous woman who is aware of her newly born independence created by her father's weakness in accepting his wife's wishes. The sense of liberation that she experiences as a future for herself is that of a mortal woman, capable of being in love and of her potential fecundity. This insight is eloquently described by William Anthrop. She becomes aware that, quote, wedlock and maternity are the true crown of womanhood, end of quote. This does not sound liberating to the modern ear. And it is the reason why Eva Reicher, in her recent book, The Women of Richard Wagner, sees Wagner's search for the ideal woman as essentially reactionary. But within the drama, access to maternal potentiality produces a new source of power and ability to transform her existence. So, when confronted with her father's threat to make her mortal and put her into an enchanted sleep and to be claimed by any man who happens to be there, she reacts in a very self-assertive way. She is no longer an adolescent daddy's girl. It is as if she becomes consciously aware that this would be the best way to avoid the destiny of being forever the favorite virgin servant of her father. So, with this new powerful strength of insight, she dares to speak her own mind for the first time and to propose her own conditions. She wants to be placed on a high mountain surrounded by a ring of fire. Only a courageous, brave man will be able to reach her. It is her condition and not a modification of her father Wotan, as most writers assume. It is also her voice, although it could be also said that Wotan's unconscious desire to preserve Siegfried. And what to make of this choice? A ring of fire. She is now aware of her own potential for essential and sexual love. There are diverse symbolisms attached to a ring. First, the circular shape could be applied to the maternal breast, but also to orifices, not only for digestive processes to take place, but also for sexual consummation in the sexual act of being penetrated, and also offers a quality of containment. The symbolic equation of fire with sexual passion can be easily understood. When sexuality was not allowed to be shown in the cinema, Hollywood filmmakers used to represent it by a fireplace with a burning red fire on the screen. They had a tacit understanding of symbolism. We have to see different meanings attached to the power of ring, but for Brunhilde, the ring symbolism and unique power is the representation of her being bonded to the man she loves. The two most important symbolic elements are the ring and the sword. In themselves, they represent the consummation of sexual love. The circular shape of the ring is the representation of the vagina, whereas the sword is easily seen as a powerful phallus. However, often the sword is in the hands of women, giving them extra power, but without ever appealing to greed or control. When to her horror, she sees Sigmund falling to the ground, her countertransferential reaction is to take care of Sieglind, knowing of her pregnancy. After all, this is in character as she is Erda's daughter. But also, being Wotan's daughter, she takes the broken sword. In both actions, we can see her feminine and masculine sides functioning together. When eventually she is awakened by Siegfried and transported to a new world of sexuality, to which she responds as a virgin maid, with both a marvelous sense of wanting to merge with him in a permanent embrace, but also with a terrible fear about her own sexuality. But what about Siegfried? Was Wagner anticipating the castration anxiety later discovered and defined by Freud? This courageous, fearless young man who has been brought up a man by a man has never seen a woman before. He has never been afraid of anything, never mind a dragon which he easily and fearlessly killed. He becomes a naive child, terrified when challenged with his own sexuality in confronting the other as a woman, a different body altogether, but most importantly, lacking a penis. It is then that he learns for the first time the meaning of fear. As such, his fear or tremendous anxiety could easily be the translation of his fear of being castrated. His exclamation, which brings titters in opera houses across the world, "It is not man! It is not a man!" depicts for Freud one of the most profound experiences a boy can undergo. And Wagner's stage directions show he took it seriously. He cries out for his mother, although he has never seen her since she died in labor. So the association is immediately made of mother, love, and death. Since then, they will be his destiny. In the Copenhagen Ring, we see the two of them in a country house in complete rapturous love with one another. But surprise, surprise, to our surprise, Brunhilde is exhibiting with great pride a pregnant body that Siegfried caresses with great care and love. From then on, Brunhilde will go displaying her pregnant condition with delight, pleasure, and even smugness. This becomes very apparent in her encounter with Waltraude, when a sea of incomprehension, this is the other Valkyria, incomprehension between the two of them is replacing the old and familiar sense of sisterhood. She is indignant about being asked for the ring to help the existence of Valhalla. Just as previously she was rebuked by Sigmund about the illusory importance of Valhalla, she is now completely dismissive about the future of that world without love. From then on, she becomes the champion of love, regardless of the dangers involved in so doing, and regardless of the destructive anger caused by the pain of thwarted love and love betrayed, she's in the last one, or the Damero. Her refusal to trade love for power drives the plot to its seemingly catastrophic conclusion, but in the wake of which a better world might emerge. And the ending? In Lloyd's production, she appears as an enraged Brunhilde being a suicide bomber, strapped with explosives which precipitate cataclysmic destruction. And in Holten's, can you put the clip in, please? She's a jubilant new mother. Okay, we'll do it. Shall I do it? As you can see now, this is a... She's now a mortal... Well, I don't know how to put it off now. Okay. She's a mortal and a free woman whose main goal is the preservation of love. This ending has required from her a profound and exhausting self-analysis, which now will be used to start a new world, where motherhood has been the production of mutual respect and pure love. Who else is able to inspire such different endings? It is this enormous complexity of Brunhilda's character able to contain and to offer these apparently close and different facets of her personality and meaning. And why not? After all, Wagner had many different drafts for the ending, and we know that it's because of Schopenhauer the end he had. But any professional, creative professional, would be free to modify. We often assume that no one knows more about psychology than the psychologist. Psychoanalytical clinicians who have a deep knowledge of the unconscious often feel themselves to be the best experts. And often this is the case, but not always. As Freud himself told the writer Stephen Zweig, okay, the pronunciation Zweig, artists know instinctively what the psychologist takes years to discover. And so too with Richard Wagner, a brilliant composer, undoubtedly, but easy to dismiss as an anti-Semite and anti-feminist. But in spite of his limitations, Wagner may yet have something vital to teach us about female psychology, something that took those of us in the mental health profession a little longer to discover. Thank you.